is number 20-3002, NRA SR Steel Minnesota LLC et al., Mesabi Metallics Co. LLC, B. Riley FBR Inc., Messrs. Berman and Pastore. Mr. Berman.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Josh Berman. I'm from the firm of White & Case, and I represent the appellants, Mesabi Metallics Corporation and Chippewa Capital Partners in this appeal.
When you're thinking about a bankruptcy jurisdiction, is it the what is asked for or the remedy that's given that tells us where we are?
Forgive me, let me make sure I understand your question.
In other words, Judge Shannon said he did not think he had jurisdiction. When you first, somebody mentions to you, is there appellate or bankruptcy jurisdiction? How do you go about doing the analysis? Do you think, okay, it's based on what we ask for or based on what is actually given?
Okay, thank you, Judge Amber. I think I understand your question. And I think the most precise answer to that question is that the court ought to look to the causes of action set forth in the complaint in the bankruptcy court. So to use Your Honor's words, in determining jurisdiction, the court should look to what is asked for. But that's not my postulation, if you will. That is exactly the approach the United States Supreme Court took in the Travelers case, which in our view, is absolutely dispositive. And if with the court's permission, I can say a few words about that case. In 1982, Johns Manville filed its much celebrated asbestos bankruptcy.
If you're in the bankruptcy world, everybody knows Johns.
You might be familiar with it. In 86, Your Honor, Travelers entered into a massive settlement agreement for hundreds of millions of dollars, which was incorporated by reference into the confirmation order. Now, 16 years later, Travelers was faced with a wave of new lawsuits. And Travelers did in that circumstance precisely.
Insurers who put up the money in 86 didn't want to be sued later on. It's
right.
Only that simple.
And so how did the Supreme Court go about evaluating precisely the question that Your Honor just asked me? It looked to the allegations in Travelers' complaint, which was filed in the first instance in the bankruptcy court, in which Travelers said these lawsuits violate the discharge injunction and the bankruptcy court's confirmation order. And despite the lapse of all that time, the Supreme Court of the United States looked to what was asked for, again in your words, and it found two things. One, this is somewhat remarkable that the question was easy, and two, that it was a plain reality, the word plain is straight out of the decision, that the bankruptcy court retained jurisdiction to enforce its own discharge injunction and its own confirmation order.
Courts have jurisdiction to construe their own orders, interpret their own orders.
That's axiomatic.
But one could argue here that there's been a conflation. That is, there is your claim in your complaint is, I want you to interpret the discharge order contained in the plan approved by the confirmation order and also contained in the confirmation order, versus what happens in terms of what you really want is, I don't want this to be decided by FINRA, I want it to be decided by you on the merits as to whether B. Riley actually has a claim. Isn't that correct?
So I don't think it's precisely correct, if I may respectfully.
Why did you, when you made the decision to leave Minnesota, come here to Delaware, what were you seeking? You're seeking a stop to the FINRA action, right?
So that was a little bit separate.
What were you seeking?
Yes, let me answer the question as simply as possible. Yes, we were seeking to end the FINRA action and to have Judge Shannon make a ruling as to whether, one, Tom Clark, who was the buyer out of the bankruptcy and who initially signed the engagement letter more than a year before the effective date in February of 2017 on behalf of his company, which was known as ERP Iron Ore, not even on behalf of the debtor, and B. Riley on the other hand.
There's certainly, as we should say in bankruptcy, there's certainly a lot of hair on it. There's no doubt about it. But the point is you come in and you say, hey, interpret this discharge order to say that the reorganized debtor and Chippewa is somehow
well,
is exonerated or released.
Sure, and I think the dates here are very important.
Those are the merits, and it didn't seem like there was any way when I read the transcript of the decision by Judge Shannon, basically saying, I don't want to get involved in this. Now, maybe what he should have said is I have jurisdiction to interpret the discharge order contained in the plan and in the confirmation order, but perhaps what he's really saying is I don't want to get involved in this, and he's either going to abstain or on the merits just say, uh-uh. So we have no jurisdiction over whether he abstained. If he did, we just don't know. But he didn't want to deal with this. Isn't that fair to say?
I think that's absolutely fair to say. But I would add something, I think, directly to Your Honor's point, which is there is a conceptual framework around the abstention doctrine that is available to bankruptcy
judges. He didn't deal with abstention.
And he didn't deal with it.
So the point is, I think what you're really saying to me is that the judge here went from first to third across pitcher's mound without touching second base.
Bingo. That's exactly right, Your Honor. And the that's why the question that is presented to the court is extraordinarily precise, which is, did the bankruptcy court err when it held that it had no jurisdiction under Section 157, no subject matter jurisdiction under Section 157 of the Bankruptcy Code, and that is a ruling.
What are the bounds around Travelers? I mean, it can't be that just invoking an order that this is going to implicate a discharge or confirmation order is enough for jurisdiction, right? So how do we put bounds on that so that litigants aren't simply manufacturing jurisdiction and it's not, as you know, your adversary suggests, a per se rule that gets everyone into bankruptcy court?
Sure. Well, without trying to posit sort of a multiplicity of circumstances, I would draw Your Honor's attention to the Resorts International case, which is a case in which this court found that the bankruptcy court properly declined to exercise so-called related to jurisdiction under the Bankruptcy Code. And a few words on the facts of that case I think will be very illuminating as to where to draw the line.
But wait, why do we get there? I mean, once there's this invocation of the court's own order that we're in the land of core proceedings, that this is arising under jurisdiction, not related to jurisdiction.
So the reason I think we don't have to address
isn't your argument that this is a core proceeding?
Absolutely. And the reason it's a core proceeding is not simply, as Judge Krause suggests, or it hypothetically suggests in the question, that we have invoked the discharge injunction and the confirmation order. It's that the specific right that we are addressing arises squarely out of the Bankruptcy Code itself. In other words, the discharge injunction that is an essential or fundamental feature of every plan of reorganization and every confirmation order is a creature of statute. And it comes straight out of Section 524A of the Bankruptcy Code itself. So the answer to your question is that when we are dealing with a right that inures to the benefit of a reorganized debtor, every reorganized debtor, by virtue of the Bankruptcy Code itself, there is subject matter jurisdiction under Section 157 vested with the bankruptcy courts.
Well, why isn't that circular? I mean, we're sort of assuming that the discharge injunction would apply in order for there to be this substantive right under the Bankruptcy Code, as opposed to looking at this as a matter of just a question of, can a third party bind an entity not yet in existence? A question that would be governed by state law and has us looking to the post-effective date.
Sure. So in a sense, you're touching on what Judge Ambrose asked, which is, do we look to your request for relief? The answer to that, I'm afraid to say, reduces to some extent to the facts of this case and the artful amendment and re-amendment by B. Riley of its own engagement letter. So when we think about what actually happened here, we have to go back to February 22nd of 2017, when the proposed buyer of the debtor, formerly known as ESML, now known as Mesaba Metallics, was still very much in the throes of the bankruptcy. And ERP, which was in a strong cash position, went out and found a financial advisor, and they signed an engagement letter. Now, the following is also crucial. The retention of professionals like B. Riley must be approved by the bankruptcy court.
If you're representing the debtor or a party in the case, right?
Right, but now we move forward in time.
Why do you need a 327 or 330 approval for engagement?
Well, this is
for a putative buyer, correct? At the beginning.
That's exactly right. And so I think my point is this is exactly the claim that I want to make the case was with Judge Shannon, but as your honors may be aware, it was administratively transferred to Judge Goldblatt when he was appointed to the bench. But that's exactly the argument that I want to make to the bankruptcy judge. Your honor, this was not a professional that was retained by the debtor.
But the point is, once you get to those merits, if you will, the fighting over the $17 million that's being asked for, if the court doesn't abstain, and if the court gets there, do you really think you're going to prevail?
I do.
What makes you think that?
The artful re-amendment and re-amendment of the engagement letter resulted in an engagement letter that happens to be dated, and I'll leave it at that, one day before the effective date of the plan.
Yes, dated December 21st.
Right, and the effective date of the plan was December 22nd. So on the face of the plan and the confirmation order itself, and under Section 520...
And you're saying also Mesaba's not a part of that, right?
Absolutely, I'm saying
that. The RPI and Chippewa, signed by Clark on behalf of them, and the reorganized debtor doesn't even exist till the next day. I got it. But I would make you a bet. Even if this goes back, the court is going to take 15 steps back and punt, one way or the other. It's either going to abstain, or it's going to say, on the merits, I'm not going to deal with it.
Look,
give you the $17 million.
That may be, but if I may respectfully push back at the idea,
or,
the overarching idea, Your Honor.
If the $17 million, the $17 million, I'm going to let FINRA decide that.
So it may well be that upon remand, Judge Goldblatt would go through the well-settled abstention analysis. Now, we argue that this is a core proceeding, and the abstention analysis is not even available to Judge Goldblatt under the rubric of the Resorts International case, which deals with related to rather than arising.
That's an argument to be made to Judge Goldblatt. If he, whatever decision he makes on abstention, I don't think we have appellate.
That's right. But we do have a statutory right for Judge Goldblatt to go through that analysis. But more than that, Your Honor, the rule articulated by Judge Shannon, if allowed to stand, would mean that debtors and reorganized debtors.
That you can take a core proceeding, deem it to be non-core, get into related to territory, and mess up the law.
You've done it better than I have.
Okay, I got it.
So why should we, a couple questions. Why should we treat this all as one matter? Isn't it possible that there's this threshold core issue of what the agreement means, but does it follow then that everything else you want that follows after that is also part of the core proceeding? I mean, I'm wondering whether there might just be core proceeding jurisdiction over the interpretation, the order under Travelers, that it might not necessarily follow that everything else you want can be shoehorned into that.
That's an interesting question, Your Honor. Thank you for asking it. Let me try to address it this way. The first step in the analysis is not what does the engagement letter mean. The first step in the analysis is a debt claimed on account of any act, omission, matter, and so forth that occurred prior to the effective date? And there is no question, it's just a matter of time and date, that the engagement letter on which B. Riley purports to rely, even though it was initially dated in February of 2017, the amended version is dated prior to the effective date. That's the threshold matter. Now, if the bankruptcy court says, look, that's a technicality, but if B. Riley had filed 2 days later, we wouldn't be here. That's a ruling that is well within the bankruptcy court's ambit to make. Right? You all know which side I would advocate, but there's no question that's within the core function of the bankruptcy judge. At that point, if the bankruptcy judge says, look, I'm not going to let you skate on the technicality, let's see whether B. Riley really is owed this money, then we look to the engagement letter. Then we look to the facts of the capital raise. Then we understand whether the raise ever actually closed. Then we understand whether
argument that they're going to make is that everything that was dealt with in the plan and confirmation order was what arose before the effective date. Isn't that right?
That's exactly right.
And the interesting thing, I look at your complaint on page 9, you quote 14.7 of the plan, and I go, and there's something left out, and there's no ellipses. What's left out is including but not limited to demands and liabilities that arose before the effective date. You've got to be careful when you go back, if you go back, that leave that in. That's the nub of their argument, and you can't take that out of 14.7 of the plan. It's already in there.
That's fair enough. I apologize for not having the complaint in front of me, Your Honor. I've got the appellate briefs.
It's on page 9 of the complaint, and it didn't make sense to me. And as I'm reading it, and as including but not specified in 502G, I'm thinking, wait, there's something before that. Turns out it's including but not limited to demands and liabilities that rose before the effective date. Now, I'm not saying it may have just been somebody putting it together, messing up, but it's like relationships. Little things mean a lot.
No, I appreciate that. I don't have an answer to tender to the court one way or the other. It sounds like it was a clerical mistake, right, but I appreciate the court's time.
Did you reserve time for rebuttal?
I'd like to, please. I see that I've gone over time in responding to your Honor's questions.
I'd ask you to talk a little bit. You really have kind of glossed over the difference between pre-confirmation and post-confirmation jurisdiction. And, you know, jurisdiction, it's axiomatic. Jurisdiction narrows after confirmation here. You know, you rely on this list of core items that are in the statute, but all of those core items are pre-confirmation items. How does your rule not amount to just creating broad post-confirmation jurisdiction going forward here? I mean, I do think there's this what's the limiting principle issue, which Judge Krause asked about, and I'm not sure I heard a clear
answer.
Can I
just add a tail? Because usually effective date and confirmation often are the same day. Here it was months apart.
That's right.
So it was be pre-effective date, I think, and post-effective date.
That's right. That was the quirk of this bankruptcy date. No, I understand the question exactly. And I think the limiting principle comes out of the bankruptcy code. I think where a plaintiff files an adversary proceeding, as my clients did, alleging a statutory right that arises out of Section 524A of the bankruptcy code, the bankruptcy code has core jurisdiction. Now, bankruptcy judges certainly are capable of saying, counsel, this was a cosmetic claim. I'm reading your complaint, and I see that you've alleged a violation of the discharge injunction, but it seems to me that you slipped that into your complaint for purposes of manufacturing jurisdiction, if you will, in the bankruptcy court, to stay, let's say, an arbitral proceeding or a FINRA proceeding. And On that basis, I don't deem you to have alleged in good faith a cognizable arising under jurisdiction under Section 157 of the Bankruptcy Code. But first of all, that's not what happened here. We have a genuine good faith belief and argument that these debts, these claimed debts, I should say, or this claimed debt was discharged, was subject to the court's discharge injunction and confirmation order. So it's not like we kind of combed through the Bankruptcy Code, if you will, leaf through the books.
But they also have a good argument that it's everything up to the effective date, but not after. And in effect, the success fee claim really arose in June of the following year, and the reorganized debtor didn't exist until after the effective date.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully don't agree that that's a good claim, and I'll tell you why if I may. There is no claim without a contract.
It doesn't make any difference for today's purposes. We're probably
fair enough. If I may just make the point,
we'll give you time on rebuttal.
Okay.
We'll give you 3 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Pastore.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Joseph Pastore. I represent B. Riley FBR, the appellee in this proceeding.
Apologize for mispronouncing it. I was thinking of the famous John Pastore from Rhode Island.
You know, it's probably Americanized years ago, but we say Pastore. That's what we said for a while. As my wife says, you don't say story, you say store. So,
First, I'm going to ask you the same question. When we think about the jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court, are we focused on what the questions are or what the answers will be?
I think what we're focused on is what relief
You sure? I mean, what relief they're asking for or what relief they're going to get?
What relief they're going to get. Because you can ask.
How do you know that at the beginning if you're a bankruptcy court? You don't.
You read the complaint.
And the complaint says what? The complaint says.
Civil contempt, declaratory
judgment, and breach of contract because. It claims that you have a discharge order or discharge provision in two places. You have it in a confirmation order and you have it in a plan. And we're asking you to interpret that. And when you go to Travelers, it looks like there's a per se rule from the Supreme Court that anytime a bankruptcy court is asked to interpret its own orders, it has jurisdiction.
I understand the question. I think that is the hub of this whole argument. That's why I thought it might be quick from maybe not. Your Honor, respectfully, I think Judge Shannon did touch second base. I think he went first to third and got the base. I think he knew exactly what he's doing. I think it was very nuanced and very smart.
That sounds like a core proceeding, not a non-core proceeding in which you would get into related to jurisdiction, in which you would get into whether there's a close nexus. Necessarily think you have to get there, do you?
I agree with you. And if you read Wieland, I think it makes clear that a core proceeding is not subject to related to jurisdiction. Very good decision a couple years ago out of the Delaware Bankruptcy Court. I still think Judge Shannon got it right. Let me explain why, if I could, briefly. I don't think
I don't want to deal with this.
Yeah, well, I get that. I think that's absolutely right, and I think he should abstain, or the new judge should abstain if it goes back. But I think the reason intellectually the judge was right and did this right, it's very nuanced, but it's very important. It's very important as guardians of bankruptcy jurisdiction and the limitations associated therewith. You can't allege violation of a discharge order and then simply create jurisdiction if there's no basis for that allegation.
No, what you can say...
And I can tell you why there's no basis.
Would it be better if you had to just do all over again, might it be more efficient for you to say, let's assume there is jurisdiction, but this is before FINRA, and why don't you just abstain, Judge? Or if you want to get to the merits, everything that they claim that gets through a release was up to the effective date and not beyond.
Judge,
my guess is you would have gotten one of those two things.
I think we did ask for that. In this case,
you asked him to abstain?
We definitely asked for him to dismiss the complaint, but we didn't ask for him to dismiss it on jurisdictional grounds. That was sua sponte. I think this panel needs to think for a second. Judge Shannon knew what he was doing. And he did so because this is manufactured jurisdiction.
Now this clearly is one of the best judges in America. There's no doubt about that.
The point here is
that maybe we in resorts and other cases weren't as clear as we thought we might be with respect to bankruptcy jurisdiction and what is core and what is non-core.
I don't think that's it. I think you're very clear. Resorts is very clear, very well done. I think what's going on is you can't, and I'm going to try to find an analogy that's appropriate, you can't put a non-football player in a Philadelphia Eagles uniform, send him on the field, and say he's a football player. You can't write a complaint.
I don't know. We've tried that a few times with the Eagles. Come on.
you can't write a complaint that says, this is a complaint about patents, and then say in the complaint, there's no patents involved, and create patent jurisdiction. In this complaint, the injunction, the discharge injunction, is about claims against the debtor. The debtor. There are no claims in our FINRA complaint about the debtor.
But doesn't this go back to how we characterize Mesabi's relationship to the Second Amendment?
And that's exactly right.
And exactly. At the time Mr. Clark signed for it, it was still a debtor. The estate was still in existence, and he was purporting to bind it at the time for something to come into effect the next day. Why isn't the question of whether it could be bound under those circumstances pre-effective date, why doesn't that fall under the court's core jurisdiction?
Because the complaint admits that B. Riley has brought no claims against the debtor, and the discharge injunction only applies to the debtor. It's claims against the debtor, and B. Riley has brought no claims against the debtor. So if it turns out the debtor was attempted to be bound, we don't win our FINRA arbitration. We brought claims against the reorganized debtor. The discharge injunction doesn't apply to claims against the reorganized debtor once the reorganized debtor is set free. And that's the critical distinction here, and that's what Judge Shannon, sua sponte, not at our suggestion, got right. And when it doesn't invoke core jurisdiction, because the discharge injunction is not really at play here, it's not really involved, because the claims have to be against the debtor. There are no claims against the debtor. FINRA claims not against the debtor. TRO wasn't against the debtor. Nothing against the debtor. It's all reorganized debtor.
That's a pretty good argument. So did you make that argument before Judge Shannon?
Judge Shannon figured this out on his own. He did the sua sponte, Judge. And he's right.
The hearing was held the day before. What was covered at that hearing?
I was there. It was an oral argument that went for about 2 hours. It was a snow day. I remember that. And we covered our motion to dismiss the complaint. I'm not even sure we touched on jurisdiction, honestly. I don't think we did. I think Judge Shannon said, this is a manufactured attempt at jurisdiction. I'm not going to countenance it. It doesn't actually invoke core jurisdiction because it's not actually going to the discharge injunction, because the discharge injunction only applies to claims against the debtor. As a result, it's only related to jurisdiction.
If you were back at that point, probably one of the arguments you would make is this is a manufactured attempt to have jurisdiction.
Whole cloth. And it leads to absurdity. It leads to absurdity.
But you would be talking about the merits and as opposed to what they're actually asking for in the complaint. So there's a split between the two, right?
Yes. I mean, we were talking about the merits at the oral argument, saying that the claim at FINRA is not covered, the injunction should be dismissed because we haven't violated the injunction because we sued the reorganized debtor. We were not talking about jurisdiction, but the same rule applies. And just think about the absurdity for a second. If I were to sue Young Clerk over there, and Young Clerk were to run to Judge Shannon in bankruptcy court and invoke the discharge injunction, would the court have core jurisdiction over that lawsuit? No, because that would be manufactured. That'd be false. It's a false choice. You have to say court jurisdiction applies when the court is actually asked to invoke the discharge injunction. But here it couldn't have.
But when the obligation arose, and in effect by having Mesabi sign on before the effective date, that's when the obligation was imputed to Mesabi.
So before the judge was a motion that said that date wasn't actually when it was signed. You know, legal closings, lawyers, the document was signed later. And the judge declined to rule on the motion, said my analysis doesn't require that analysis. And so he said, no, I'm not going to rule on that issue. Because it's about, for him, was this claim against the debtor? The debtor. And it can't be against the debtor. The person who signed it had no authority to bind the debtor. It's physically impossible for us to have sued the debtor on this contract. Impossible. Therefore, we're not invoking the discharge injunction. We can't be. We can't be. And the absurdity I'm talking about is what you have to guard against as guardians of the limited jurisdiction of bankruptcy courts. It's an absurdity to say that every time someone writes discharge injunction, even if it's wholly inapplicable, the court has core jurisdiction. What the judge said is, no, I don't have core jurisdiction because it's not really about the discharge injunction. I have related to jurisdiction.
The judge could say, I have authority to, as a core proceeding, to interpret my discharge order. However, in this particular case, either I abstain or I note that on the merits, the reorganized debtor really isn't even bound by the Second Amendment. It clearly wasn't part of the First Amendment. Clearly wasn't part of the initial engagement agreement. And therefore, one way or the other, you could say you win, right?
That's true.
You go back to FINRA.
That's true, and that is our goal. It's been a couple of years. But I still stand by. I married when I was there.
The FINRA case matter is what's the... It's an arbitration, is that right?
It's a securities arbitration over the engagement agreement, the services provided by my client for which they have nothing.
And that's been stayed?
It's been stayed.
Okay.
But I just like to make one important point. In the injunction complaint itself, paragraph 50, Mesabi is not a signatory to the second amended agreement, Mesabi the debtor. Paragraph 15, defendant was never retained by the debtor. The injunction is for claims against the debtor. No claims are ever made against the debtor. Therefore, the injunction is not appropriately before the judge. Therefore, he's not exercising core jurisdiction. But it is related to, under resorts, it's related to.
That's why I asked the very first question I asked. Is it the question, is when you think about bankruptcy jurisdiction, are you considering what's asked by the party filing the complaint or what ultimately you give? At the beginning, it has to be what you ask for?
But not if the complaint collapses on its own language like this one does. Because if not, you're going to have an absurdity again.
On the merits, it may collapse on its own language of what's in the plan and what's in the Second Amendment to the engagement agreement.
But I understand. My point is if the court...
That's the second base that you have to touch is you may have jurisdiction, but you're still going to end up with third base, which is I ain't going to deal with it. Or you, B. Riley, win because of the reasons that you're giving on the merits.
I understand what you're saying, but I think the judge did touch second base because I think his analysis says you cannot falsely manufacture core jurisdiction by simply using the word discharge injunction if my analysis is the discharge injunction is not invoked.
But that's not what Judge Shannon said. What he said was, this doesn't look to me as if I have a bankruptcy jurisdiction because this is a related to matter and it does not appear in this related to matter that there is a close nexus to what went on here. Therefore, I do not have jurisdiction. But then the question becomes, but what if it isn't a non-core matter? What if it's a core matter?
If it's a core matter, I would concede there's jurisdiction. But it's not a core matter if you're just falsely.
But then how do I get around Travelers to say it's not a core matter?
Because, you can't create patent jurisdiction if you write the word patent, but there's no patent involved.
What are the words in Travelers? Do you have them in front of you?
I don't have Travelers in front of me, but I've read it carefully. So.
And it's basically that a bankruptcy court has bankruptcy jurisdiction over matters that relate to the interpretation of its orders, among other things, right?
Correct. I don't think Judge Shannon said, I'm not interpreting my order. There's no quibbling about the plain language of my order. The discharge injunction applies to the debtor.
But again, from your position, it's both sides assumed a so what. But you might want to just have said it, so what? There's jurisdiction here. It may be core jurisdiction. They ain't going to win. They're not going to win here. Because either he's going to abstain or he's going to go to the merits, and it's going to be something that you look at to for the release as of the effective date, not what happens after the effective date, especially when the claim comes into existence 6 months later.
That's right. I mean, we think we're on the right here. We think we provided services and didn't get paid. It's pretty straightforward.
Anything further you want to add?
I would just ask you just to consider that Judge Shannon did think this through, and when he did the related to analysis, it was because he determined it wasn't core because the discharge injunction was not applicable. It is related to. He did that analysis and said
what you're saying is he's looking through it and he's seeing what it really is.
Yeah, all he's saying you can't manufacture core jurisdiction. It has to actually exist.
All right. Any further questions?
Thank you, panel. I appreciate it.
Give you 3 minutes, and Mr. Berman.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I'm glad to have the opportunity to address the court again.
What makes you think that this, if you were to get to the merits, what makes you think that the reorganized debtor is a party to the Second Amendment?
So we absolutely have a substantive defense to say, hey, we weren't a party, but We kept hearing from my colleague, Mr. Pastor, that there are no claims against the debtor. There are no claims in this debt against the debtor. Of course there are claims against the debtor.
There are claims against the reorganized.
Right. And please allow me to quote to Your Honors from Judge Shannon's own confirmation order, which read as follows.
Which provision?
14.6 of the Third Amended Plan of Reorganization.
Okay, got it. Discharge of liabilities. Go ahead.
The way the paragraph begins is except as otherwise provided in the plan. And then I'm going to skip a couple of sentences mindfully but cautiously.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's skip stuff again.
Right. Holders of claims shall be precluded from asserting against the reorganized debtor, the debtors, their assets, or any property dealt with under the plan, any further claim based on any act, omission,
into existence prior to the effective date.
Right. So without a contract, without an alleged contract, which we would allege that we would, on the substance or on the merits, say, look, is non-binding as to us. But without a contract, B. Riley has no claim against Mesabi Metallics. And so to say to this court that we sued a stranger for violating a patent, even though we really just got into an automobile collision and tried to get before the Court of Federal Claims, is really an inapposite analogy. This was a multi-year, multi-billion-dollar bankruptcy relating to an ongoing iron ore project. There are still several major, again, multi-billion-dollar adversary proceedings now before Judge Goldblatt, who took the baton from Judge Shannon. And the claim for civil contempt of the discharge order, declaratory judgment, and violation of the plan is very far from manufactured. Those are bona fide, genuine claims that vested Judge Shannon with core jurisdiction under Travelers. There is no way to get around Travelers. Now, they may win, ultimately, before Judge Goldblatt.
You know what my bet is.
I think you made that clear. But I don't want to wade into the merits. We do believe we have good substantive responses. But I think, irrelevant to the narrow jurisdictional issue before the court.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel for being with us.
Thank you very much.
A case like this.